From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we catch up with one of the powerful voices from the early days of rock and roll. Laverne Baker's hits included Bumblebee and Jim Dandy. Also today, we meet David Alan Greer, one of the stars of In Living Color. And commentator Maureen Corrigan tells us about Betty, a female vocal trio with a cult following. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell has sharply condemned President Bush's plan to extend China's most favored nation trading status for another year. The president made the announcement at Yale University's graduation ceremonies today. Alan Dowd from Maine Public Broadcasting reports.
Mitchell, a longtime critic of China's human rights policies, says the president's proposals are an affront to international standards of decency.
The president's policy with respect to China is without any moral or logical basis. It is inconsistent with American interests and contrary to American ideals. The proposed sanctions are a joke. I'm sure the Chinese communist leaders are right at this moment celebrating.
Mitchell said Congress will do everything it can to fight the policy. Mitchell lost an attempt last year to block the extension of China's favorable trading status, but he says he feels many Republicans who supported the president in that vote will now go against him. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Dowd in Portland, Maine.
Afghanistan's Soviet-backed government has offered a ceasefire to rebels in order to pave the way for a United Nations peace plan. Afghan President Najibullah ordered his military commanders to observe a truce in their regions if the rebels will agree to it. The peace plan, proposed last week by UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar, has now been accepted by Pakistan, the Soviet Union, and Afghanistan. Thai airport authorities are denying reports that a bomb could have been the cause of the crash of a Lauda Airlines 767 over Thailand. At least 223 people were killed in the mid-air crash. Neil Kelly filed this report for the BBC and says official Thai claims about the cause of the crash conflict with other expert opinion.
According to the experts, who wish to remain anonymous, the airliner could have been torn apart by an exploding engine or by a bomb. But the manager of the Bangkok airport said sabotage was out of the question, as security arrangements, which met the highest international standards, would prevent anyone putting a bomb on a plane. He blamed bad weather for the crash. The Thai authorities are sensitive to complaints about airport security. Two airliners have been hijacked in recent times after leaving Bangkok. At the crash site, police said about 150 bodies had been recovered. But there have been conflicting statements about the black box flight recorder. Police said it had been found, but that was denied by the airline.
Neil Kelly in Bangkok. The United States is urging Ethiopian rebels to move into Addis Ababa to restore order following a government-ordered ceasefire. Rebel sources say that government army deserters are looting and fighting each other in the capital city. This is NPR News from Washington. Opposition leaders met today with the Kuwaiti monarch demanding that martial law be ended and the constitution restored. The meeting came as Kuwaiti government officials indicated that martial law would be extended for another month. Leaders from seven different opposition groups asked the emir to stop the mistreatment of foreigners in Kuwaiti jails, allow a free press, and find a solution to the problem of stateless people in the country. The meeting came a day after Kuwait's crown prince made a television address warning that what he called lawlessness on Kuwait's streets would be severely dealt with. U.S. soldiers based in Iraq are making the best of this Memorial Day. NPR's Marie Dilge visited the combined Army-Marine compound in Zaqo and has this report.
It's definitely a holiday at the compound. Even the latrine factory is closed today. And the soldiers, usually running around in their camouflage uniforms, are stripped down to their shorts for a game of volleyball. Sergeant Martin Duncan is communications chief for the command element, but today his only job is to referee a volleyball game between a group of Marines and some Army soldiers.
After a while, doing the same thing over and over again, we get kind of bored. So this breaks the monotony of what we are doing, takes our mind down a little bit. And, well, we're still got an edge on, but it takes your mind off what's going on around here.
The most talked about event today is perhaps the cookout, grilled hamburgers and hot dogs, providing a much-needed break from their rations. The soldiers say the only things missing are beer and, of course, their families. I'm Marie Dilge reporting.
Top finance officials in Germany predicted today that the world's seven major industrial nations will support Soviet President Gorbachev in his economic reforms. Gorbachev has asked for an invitation to the G7 economic summit in July so that he can appeal for help with the Soviet economic crisis. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Laverne Baker is one of the rhythm and blues stars of the 50s and early 60s, about whom you might ask, where is she now? Well, the answer is, she's back in the States performing, and she's our guest today. Baker is one of Atlantic Records' first big success stories, with hits like Jim Dandy, Tweedledee Dee, and Bumblebee. And it was Atlantic Records that revived her career in 1988 by having her perform in their 40th anniversary celebration at Madison Square Garden. More recently, she performed in the Broadway R&B review Black and Blue, and she recorded a song for the Dick Tracy soundtrack. I'll let Laverne Baker explain where she was in the intervening 20 years after we hear this 1956 recording.
Jim Dandy to the rescue. Jim Dandy to the rescue. Jim Dandy to the rescue. Go, Jim Dandy. Go, Jim Dandy. Jim Dandy on a mountain top. 30,000 feet to drop. Spider lady on a runaway horse. Aha, that's right, of course. Jim Dandy to the rescue. Go, Jim Dandy. Go, Jim Dandy. She was feeling a kind of blue. Jim Dandy is the kind of guy. Never liked to see a little girl cry. Jim Dandy to the rescue. Go, Jim Dandy. Go, Jim Dandy. Jim Dandy to the rescue. Jim Dandy to the rescue. Jim Dandy to the rescue. Go, Jim Dandy. Go!
Laverne Baker, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Now, you just performed at the Village Gate, a club in New York. What did you sing? What's in your repertoire now?
Well, right now, the people are so interested in hearing my old recordings. So that's basically what I'm doing with a few other songs. But I'm putting my act together for California, which I will be doing other songs to show the versatility of my voice, you know, and things that I can do. Which I would like to do here, but the people, I know, God bless them, they just want to hear what they like. So that's what I do here, is I do a few outsiders, you know, but basically the act I'm doing now is from the 50s and all of my hits.
Now, in the 20 years or so that you weren't performing in the States, you were living in the Philippines?
Yes, I'm the show director for the United States Marine Corps. I'm still active in show business. I book all the shows in the club. And on Fridays and Saturdays, I sing myself. I do four sets on Friday, four sets on Saturday. And for the happy hour, you know, I laugh and talk with the guys, go around. You know, it makes them feel good and keeps up the morale. That is my job, to make everybody laugh and happy. And it has been very successful there.
What kind of other talent did you book for the shows?
Well, I booked all Filipino talent. And I had all the agents. I have a vast list of agents that I deal with by phone, and some of them, if they have the money, they come down. And we book whatever I think is suiting for the club. You know, if they've had too much singing, then I'll bring in like acrobats and tumblers and stuff like that. And if I think they've had too much of female, I'll bring in a mixed show, like the Philippine cultural dances and stuff like that. It's whatever I feel that we're needed, you know. And it's like if the ships are coming in, then I book the show full of beautiful girls because the guys don't want to see no guys, you know. So when the carriers are coming in, it's quite wild there. You know, we have sometime like 8,000 guys at one time, you know, in there.
Well,
yeah.
Well, let's listen to another one of your hit records from the 1950s before we talk some more. And why don't we listen to Bumblebee?
Oh, wow.
I think, you know, this is kind of a novelty record, but it's a wonderful recording.
Yes, I'm singing it now, and I feel so very, very funny singing that.
Why do you feel funny about it?
Well, because I was, you know, very, very young, and at the time it fitted me, you know. It was good, and I had a big hit with it with the kids. But now I'm much older. I feel funny singing it, you know, but I'll do it. You know, I do it. And I'm surprised that my voice can reach the squeaky part now. I still can do it. So I'll do it. You know, if someone asks for it, I'll do it.
So do you do it differently?
No, I do it the same. The same. I do all of my recordings identical, the same. Matter of fact, I have hired two backup singers to do the background so that the people will know, you know, what they heard before. It still sounds the same.
Okay, let's listen to Laverne Baker, and this is Bumblebee.
Shuck, shuck, shuck.
I'm gonna have to put you
shuck,
down.
Shuck, shuck.
You've been treating me like a
shuck,
child.
Shuck, shuck.
You know you've hurt me once before.
Shuck, shuck. Shuck.
You'll never hurt me anymore.
Shuck, shuck.
Evil bumblebee.
Shuck, shuck.
I gave you love as sweet as honey.
Shuck,
my life, my soul, and all my money.
Shuck,
you didn't seem to realize
shuck, shuck.
You had a home in paradise.
Shuck. Shooey, you hurt me like a bee.
A bumblebee, an evil bumblebee. One kiss before you go. Don't ever come back no more. Now, baby, there's no need of crying.
Shuck, shuck.
I'm sick and tired.
So my guest Laverne Baker is recorded in 1960. Now, Laverne Baker, you were born in Chicago, and you started performing in your teens.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And when you started performing in clubs around Chicago, you were known as Little Miss Sharecropper. Who gave you that name?
Regretfully, yes. Some guy. Well, it was a long story. It's like at the big club, De Lisa, which was the place during those early 40s, 50s in Chicago. And they had a singer there named Little Miss Cornshuck. And she was a great singer. And she used to come out with a little, like, Bo Peep outfit on with a little basket and mm-hmm. ribbons in her hair. And she was, quite famous. Her name was the Talk of Chicago. And she got on the wrong path, you know, and wasn't able to perform. So then they were looking for someone to take her place. So I met this guy at another one of our big clubs. I had went to see the show, and I did a guest number. And he said, you know, they're looking for a good singer at Club De Lisa. So I was a little nervous to go to the breakfast dance because I didn't have no business out that, you know, all night long at that during those years, you know, because the breakfast dance started at 6 o'clock in the morning. But I slipped and went anyway, and I got the job. And the next thing I knew, they had put these little costumes and ribbons and baskets in my hand, and they called me Little Miss Sharecropper because they couldn't use corn shuck. You know, and Sharecropper was related to that. But about 2 years after I left, I hurried up and got rid of it. So,
did you protest when they wanted to outfit you that way? And
no,
call you
I
that?
Didn't. You know, you got to get your foot in the door before you can say anything in regards to what you do. You know, I wasn't strong. I just wanted to get started, and I didn't care how, you know, as long as it was legit, you know. So they wanted me to sing. And hey, I enjoyed it for a while, you know. But then as I started to mature, you know, and I saw other singers, you know, looking so beautiful on stage, I didn't like it anymore.
Now, I want to read you a review from Variety. And this is from 1954, the year that you signed with Atlantic.
Wow.
And this is a review of you at the Apollo.
Oh, I see.
And the reviewer wrote, "She's a strong-voiced looker who embellishes her singing with movement and suggestiveness worthy of any grind artist. And while this goes well at the Apollo, she'll have to hold back in other situations." weird review, but I was wondering, you know, what were you doing in your act then, and did you have to change what you were doing
in
terms of emotions?
Yes. As you mature, you know, like for one-nighters and the Apollo, that was great, you know?
What were you doing?
I have a thing I do. I turn around and my behind moves, you know, and stuff like that. You know, I still can do it. You know, it's all muscle control type thing, you know. But the audience go crazy when you do this, you know, and the young audience is back then in rock and roll. And at that time, I was not playing sophisticated and big nightclubs. I was doing strictly one-nighters and theaters. So I had to stick to it. But, you know, as I got a little older, I wanted to change, and I did change. And I made it. I went to Basin Street East with Louis Armstrong more than one time, you know. And I played Vegas. And these are rooms and things that I could not get when I was in rock and roll. So I had to change my act, you see.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were one of the first black singers to cross over to a white teenage audience.
Yes.
In the 1950s. Was there a conscious attempt at Atlantic Records to give you a certain kind of material or to change your stage act in any way to help you cross over?
No, the music, Atlantic always picked my music, Ahmed and Jerry at the time. They always picked, you know, the songs that they wanted me to sing or they thought that would be best for me. And I never argued at that particular time. I'll fight now, but I didn't argue then. And because they knew what they wanted, you know. But coincidentally, the things that they gave me, I enjoyed doing at that time. So I gave my best at it, you know. And sometimes they would come in the studio and play different things and holler in the background, you know, to make it better, you know, sound like more people.
Did holler in the background on the record?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which
yeah.
record did they do that on?
Quite a few. They'd sing with at that time we had a group called, a backup group called the Q's. And a lot of things he'd come in and he'd show them, he'd sing with them to show them what he wanted, you see. And this is the way we worked back then, you know. We had a small room and it was, like they were on one side and we were on the other, and, you know, and we made millions of hits up there in that little hole that we were in.
Now, I want to play Tweedledee D, but you know, the voices that come in at the beginning,
uh-huh.
They're kind of square sounding voices, don't you think?
Yes, yeah. These are the cues, and one of the cues is the one that wrote Tweedledee D, Mr. Winfield Scott. He's the one that wrote it, and that is the longest recording session I've ever had in my life.
What made it so long?
We did 52 takes.
Whoa, you're kidding.
No, I kid you not.
How come? What went
wrong?
Well,
he wasn't satisfied. It was something missing, and during the break, we know they always give us a little break for tea or whatever to rest our voices, you know. And I did, I was kidding with it, and I said, hump, be hump, bump, bump, like that. And Ahmed said, that's it, that's it. That's how that got in there. You know, it was just something missing that he wasn't. And he's like that now, you know. He's like that now. Everybody say he's still the same. If he's in a date and he's not comfortable, you know, he knows what he like, you know. And if he don't hear it, he'll keep pushing, you know. So that's that with the Tweedledee session. It was very, very long.
Well, why don't we listen to Tweedledee? And this is my guest, Laverne Baker.
I'm as happy as can be. Chimney Cricket, Chimney Jack, you make my heart go clickety clack. Tweedledee, Tweedledee, Tweedledee.
This Laverne Baker is recorded in 1955, a song that went up to number 14 on the charts. Big hit for you. Now, how did you feel when you were given the song? Did you like the song?
Yes and no.
What was the yes and what was the no?
Well, because, you know, I told you we did so many takes. And it just didn't make any sense to me, okay? You know, and
but the lyric or the
yeah, the lyric. The music was okay. We had to find the music to really fit it, you know. So I came up with a suggestion of Brazil, if you notice, it's
dun, at the beginning, yeah.
Yeah, dun-dun-dun, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. So, you know, and that's why I was so upset when Georgia Gibbs covered my record, because we worked very hard to stay away from the main track of Brazil, just a little taste of it, you know. And then she recorded my song word for word. I was very upset with this, because she used my arrangement. Use your own arrangement, you know. That's what, that was the only kick, because once the song is PD, public domain, anybody can sing it, you know. I was really upset with the arrangement, because we worked very hard on that.
Georgia Gibbs' cover of your record went up to number 2 on the charts.
I know. It was so many people had they thought they had the original, and they didn't. They had hers.
Now, she was a white singer.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Recording your hit.
Yeah.
Were there stations that would play the white singer's version of it that wouldn't play yours?
Oh, yeah. And there were some of them that played hers, and after they found out she wasn't the original, they wouldn't play it anymore. You know, this happened in the whole state of Illinois and Michigan.
Did you play a lot of the rock and roll shows that were put together by Alan Freed and
Yes,
Murray
I
McKay?
Did. Yeah.
What was it like to perform with those? Who were some of the people who shared the bill with you? And what?
Oh, so
what
many.
Was it? Yeah.
Oh, so many. I wish I had known you were going to ask me that. Let's see. The last show I did with Freed, I think, was at the Brooklyn Paramount. It was Chuck Berry, and I got my eyes closed trying to remember this. It was Chuck Berry, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, the Everly Brothers, Paul Anka, Screaming Jay Hawkins, Bill Doggett. Oh, quite a few. I can't remember them all.
What a show.
Yeah, he used to carry, we had 2 busloads full to capacity and maybe 4 cars all the time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Laverne Baker, and she had a lot of hits in the 1950s, early 60s, songs like Tweedledee Dee, Bumblebee, Jim Dandy, I Cried a Tear. And she's back in the States after about 20 years and performing again, and her hits have just been reissued on compact disc. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Laverne Baker is my guest. In the 1950s, you recorded an entire album of Bessie Smith songs.
Oh, I loved it. Now, that's a recording date I enjoyed. I really did enjoy it. I loved the songs. And after I listened to Bessie Smith, and even now that I'm older, when I do her numbers, I sound more like her, you know. I was told that by the bass player and some of the guys who actually worked with Bessie Smith, that was still living, Atlantic got the some of the original guys that played with her, you know, and they told me, said, man, you really sound like Bessie, you know. I just had one of those big growling voices, I guess, you know, and it's worse now that I'm older.
Well, it's a great album, and it was reissued recently on compact disc.
Yeah.
So let's play something off of it. This is the opening track, and this is Pigfoot.
Oh.
We're gonna be resting when the wagon comes. I won't.
That sounds really terrific. Was Bessie Smith a big influence on you?
No. Let's say singers from that era did, you know. And then my mom and my grandmom, they were all gospel singers in church. So naturally I grew up in church, you know, that's where most of us come from, you know.
What was it like for you in the 60s when you stopped having hit records and when the kind of records making the pop charts were changing?
Well, I tell you what, I was a smart cookie. I left before it stopped. I realized it was getting slow, and I guess the good Lord was with me. My Asian tour came in right in the middle of that. And I said, well, let me get this, because in Asia, and you play in the military bases, and they know you, you know, and at that time, you know, it was great, and I had a good show put together. So I really forgot all about it, you know.
This was what, a USO tour?
No, I don't do USO. I go over independently and by myself, you know, and I travel from, my tour went from Tokyo to Vietnam and back again to Guam.
So you're still living in the Philippines?
Yes, I still maintain my kids are there, and but I'm going to go and close out my house and file my petition to get my baby out, because my baby is half-half. She's half Filipino and half American. So I have to go through quite a bit to get her papers ready to get her out of the Philippines, and then I will resign my post, because I still carry my contract and ID cards for the base. And then my mother wants me to come home, so I think I'll come home for whatever time God has for me left. I will spend it here in America.
Will you be recording again soon?
I pray so. Well, I just had a new release, a CD, of all my, some of my old hits, released by Warner Atlantic. You know, they're together. And it's on sale here in New York now. I don't know about other cities, but you can get it. It's got Tweely D, I Cried a Tear, and so forth and so on. It's a reissue, you know, but it's on CD.
Great.
Uh-huh. But we're going to do some more, and I'm hoping to do some more recording. I have several offers, but I'm still holding out because I want to stay with Atlantic if I can. They're lucky for me, you know?
Yeah.
They have been very great for me, you know. So, but, you know, I don't mind. I want to try something of the new stuff, you know. If I can't make it, then I can't make it. But I would like to try. I'm the type, I'll try it, you know. I'm not a giver up. I fight, you know. And I want to make a rap record.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I want to rap with something in my groove, you know, just to fight back with the youngsters.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Laverne Baker, I thank you very much for talking with us. It's really been fun to hear from you. Thank you.
And I'd like to thank you very, very much. And you have a nice day.
Here's more from Laverne Baker from the soundtrack of Dick Tracy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
We're twisted and we're shaking, but don't you let it break, 'cause I need every ounce of it to bake my cake. 'Cause I'm a slow-rolling mama, and I need a big, long rolling pin to get it ready and just right, woo, for my red-hot oven. Honey, let's roll it slow and easy, if it takes all night, 'cause if you try to rush it, it'll never come out right. 'Cause I'm a slow-rolling mama, oh, and I need a big, long rolling pin.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Coming up, we meet one of the stars of In Living Color, one of the stars who is not a member of the Wayans family. David Alan Greer has originated many characters on the show. He's the blues singer Calhoun Tubbs, the homeboy film producer Clavel, and one of the men in Men on Film. Also, Maureen Corrigan introduces us to the silly, smart aleck singing trio, Betty. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Ethiopia, as rebel forces appear on the verge of entering the capital, gunfire was heard this evening, and remnants of government troops gathered around the presidential palace. This came on a day when U.S.-sponsored peace talks got underway in London, and there was news that all parties had agreed to a ceasefire. Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
The surprise announcement was made by Undersecretary of State for African Affairs, Herman Cohen. He said the U.S. government had recommended that the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, the EPRDF, be allowed to enter the city and be responsible for order. The announcement in London confirms the situation on the ground in Ethiopia. The army has collapsed, and with it, the authority of the interim government. The EPRDF has had Addis Ababa surrounded since last Friday and is considered the strongest military force in the country. The EPRDF is one of three rebel groups taking part in the peace talks along with the interim government. Today's ceasefire is the first step in a process that participants hope will lead to a transitional government and real power sharing among Ethiopia's ethnic groups. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Goldfarb in London.
President Bush says that he wants to extend most favored nation trade benefits to China for another year. Speaking today at Yale, Mr. Bush said that he knows this is a controversial step, but he feels it is the best chance to get China to change its ways. Critics on Capitol Hill say that they will try to block an extension of trade privileges because of China's hardline policies concerning dissidents and trade. Bush administration officials say that sales of high-tech equipment to China will now be restricted because of Chinese sales of long-range missiles to Pakistan. Following a meeting today with Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney, France's Minister of Defense said that France had no intention of undermining NATO. However, both men indicated that they have differences on the future role of NATO. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
French Defense Minister Pierre Jacques said that France and the U.S. have similar ideas on the best way to move forward in adapting the Atlantic Alliance to the new situation in Europe. He said France has no intention of undermining NATO. At the same time, the French would also like to increase European defense cooperation, and they propose that the Europeans create a rapid action force. NATO is considering a similar idea, and following their meeting today, Secretary of State Cheney said the U.S. would like such a force to be under NATO command. He said the fundamental goals and objectives of France and the U.S. are the same, but he added there are still ongoing discussions about the future role of NATO. The two leaders decided to hold regular meetings about the changing situation in the Soviet Union and the future of the Atlantic Alliance. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
This is National Public Radio News. No survivors have been found in the crash of an Austrian jetliner in Thailand. The plane, a Boeing 767 with 223 people on board, went down shortly after taking off from Bangkok last night. No official cause of the crash has been given, but news reports quoted witnesses as reporting that the plane exploded. An airline spokesman said that about 16 minutes after taking off, the control tower reported that the plane simply disappeared from radar. The airplane was flown by an American pilot with 14,000 hours of flying time. In India, a train carrying former Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi's ashes is making its way through the northern part of the country. Along the way, the train has been mobbed by tens of thousands of mourners. Sam Miller filed this report for the BBC.
At the town of Khurja, the train stopped for 20 minutes, and a large group of screaming mourners broke through the security cordon and pressed themselves up against the white carriage containing the ashes of Mr. Gandhi. Their screams of Rajiv Gandhi is immortal were drowned out by loudspeakers attached to each corner of the carriage, playing religious music at high volume. Inside the carriage sits Mr. Gandhi's family, his wife Sonia, his son Rahul, and his daughter Priyanka, and other relatives and close friends. White mattresses cover the floor of the carriage, which is bare except for garlands of flowers and a small raised wooden platform. On the platform are two copper urns containing the ashes of Mr. Gandhi.
Sam Miller reporting for the BBC. According to reports from India, a woman has been held for questioning in connection with the murder of former Prime Minister Gandhi. According to news reports, police are also looking for a man who posed as a journalist at a rally where Gandhi was slain. It's believed that Gandhi was killed by a woman with a bomb strapped to her body. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. One of the funniest shows on TV is In Living Color. A lot of viewers have come to think of it as a younger, hipper, blacker answer to Saturday Night Live. The show is on Sunday nights on the Fox Network. My guest is one of the stars of In Living Color, David Alan Greer. When the show's creator, Keenan Ivory Wayans, invited Greer to join the cast, Greer turned him down several times.
Because this was at a point in that year, I had auditioned for almost 50 pilots. And it was at a point in my career where the casting directors would call if it was like for an albino midget. It would be like 15 albinos and then me in the room. I was like the, I don't know, I was that one actor like, hey, we may go a different way. And I auditioned for everything that year. I just didn't think this was right for me or whatever. I don't know. You know, my ego, whenever I try and make a decent decision, it always blows up in my face. But anyway, so my wife talked me into it. Kim Wayans talked me into it. And I went in and I auditioned. And it wasn't really an audition. It was an improv. And I had so much fun at this audition. I didn't want to leave. We just improv for like an hour and a half. And Keenan was there. And he would bring in groups of people. And it was so much fun. He asked me to do it. And I said, yeah. You know, finally, I said, yeah. And I'm really glad I did.
Yeah, I'm glad you did, too. Let's talk about some of the characters that that you've done, some of the recurring characters that you've done. Now, a character you've done a lot is an old blues singer, an old blind blues singer, or is he really blind?
Yeah, right. Calhoun Tubbs. Calhoun Tubbs is like the worst blues singer in the world.
Thank you very much. All right. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Calhoun Tubbs. Known to my friends as Hard Fingers. See, that's because back in 1947, I once played the guitar for over 36 hours straight for no reason at all. That's right. I wrote a song about it. Like to hear it, here go. I played guitar for 36 hours. Thank you very much. You know, I'd like to welcome y'all to my 75th anniversary show. That's right. 75 years in the business of the blues. Still trying to make it. I wrote a song about it, like the kid did go. 75 years and show that nice, and I'm still trying to make it.
I was doing a movie in Canada, and my wife and I, we went to this little bar, and I said, wow, you know, this old blues guy's there. And there are all these white people were packed in this little coffee house, and this guy had to be the worst. He couldn't play guitar. He couldn't sing. You know, his songs were terrible. And yeah, there are all these kids, you know, like all these college students were packed around him like he was a messiah, you know, like this guy was a real blues singer. And we were in the back laughing our heads off, man. So that was the idea for Calhoun Tubbs, this guy who's really terrible, a terrible blues singer, but he's got a lot of heart.
And people fall for him.
Yes, yes, yes.
Now, another character I like a lot, this was not a recurring character, but this was a sketch you starred in called John Sidekick.
Oh, you know, I loved that sketch, and we kept trying to bring him back, and we probably will next year, but we just couldn't find the right thing. And John's sidekick is just, you know, just what it is. It's like in every action adventure movie, you know, there's always the white guy is always the one who gets shot. He takes the fall. He beats everybody up, and you know, he has a black sidekick who never does anything. You know, he never gets the girl, but he's always there as the best friend. You know, the generic asexual sidekick, and that was our tribute to him. Yeah, I like that, man. As a matter of fact, when we were shooting that in Los Angeles, the guy was chasing me, and the police pulled up. You know, they screech up there, and it was really funny, you know. So the guy had to put the gun down, and we all, you know, were up against the fence and the whole thing.
Oh, jeez. So what happened?
Nothing. We got out alive. You know, thank God there was a camera there, but it was, you know, we knew it was going to happen.
Really?
It was so strange. We did know. Yeah.
How did he treat you before he found out that you were shooting something?
Ah, man. You know, there was a camera there, you know, and there's two black guys. And we both have guns, but there's a camera there. So it would make sense to you that we're not, like, robbing anybody. But, you know, I'm just glad the camera was there, or else it could have been a long night. You may have been looking at videotapes of me instead of Rodney King, you know.
Now, one wonderful thing about the show is that because there are so many black performers in it, you can spoof characters and ideas that really whites couldn't touch, because it might be considered racist if whites took on kind of black characters like that. Two, they couldn't do it, just sort of physically.
Yeah.
And three, they wouldn't know enough. Do you know what I mean? There's some kind of inside humor in there that because you're doing people who come from your life. You know, people who you know.
Right.
It's based on people who, a lot of the characters are based on people who you know.
Right.
So you get inside it in a way that I think white comics or white actors couldn't.
Well, I don't think they really think about it. You know, it was like when I did Soldier's Story, when I first saw the play a few years ago, it was great to see more than one black voice on stage. You know, there were good people, bad people, people who you didn't agree with, people who you totally agreed with, people who were like out in left field. And I think that's what you get when you have more than one black voice or more than one Hispanic voice or more than one Asian voice. Then you can represent a multi-textured and multi-layered community, but when you have one ethnic minority, then that person has to speak for like 400 years of oppression, and you know,
right.
He has to please everyone, and usually the minority community is dissatisfied, the performer is not served, the piece isn't served, and everyone comes out frustrated because it's just hard to do, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So whenever you have like one black actor or one woman or, you know, one Asian and in a mixed, you know, all whites or whatever, I think it's really hard to come out successfully.
My guest is David Alan Greer, one of the stars of In Living Color. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. David Alan Greer is my guest. Now, the Wayans, I think, grew up in a housing project, whereas you come from a much more prosperous family. Your father was a psychiatrist. He was the author of the book Black Rage.
There's a lot of pain there. Excuse me.
Does this affect the kind of roles that you get on the show, coming from a more middle-class background?
No, I think it affects the way people perceive you. You know, if they don't know that about me, then you know, it doesn't affect that. But what affects it more is that I went to an Ivy League school, so I always get Yale, you know, this Yale thing. Oh, you went to Yale, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And because I'm a, quote, classically trained actor, then I get teased a lot, you know. But, you know, I just give them peace of my mind and iambic pentameter and all that stuff. it does sometimes to them, but, you know, I feel like I've proven myself. I feel like I've proven my versatility. Sometimes I wish I could play more, you know, street people or whatever, you know, because I know I have the capacity to do that as an actor, you know, but I think it's more the way you carry yourself or something. You know, in this business, you're only perceived by the last thing you did. Before I did a sitcom, I did a sitcom a couple of years ago called All Is Forgiven for NBC, and my agents would try and submit me on comedy projects, and they said that the casting director said, oh, but he's not funny, because they'd never seen me be funny. So therefore, they thought that I wasn't funny. I'd only done serious roles. And now, because I've done this comedy stuff, I think I have to reestablish myself in a serious mode.
Right.
You know, because now the casting directors are going, oh, he's funny, you know, that kind of stuff. So you're always reinventing yourself.
Now, I have to ask you about your father's book, Black Rage. It's a book I've seen, but I've never read. What's it about?
Well, this came out in a time, like I was a real little kid, and it came out in a time in the 60s, you know, and it was black consciousness and that kind of thing. So what it basically was, it was like, it talked about the state of the black family in America, the fact that a lot of families in America, in urban America, are matriarchs, and the reasons why that was, and, you know, what brought us to this state as black people, that kind of thing. And so it got a lot of attention, and for that time, it was a big deal.
What was it like for you to grow up in such a racially conscious home?
Well, you know, my parents were divorced at the when I was 10. Oh. And when he wrote the book, he was in San Francisco. I just remember visiting him, and he would take us by, like, the Berkeley Draft Board, and he would take us to Haight-Ashbury and Telegraph and all that stuff and the Black Panther headquarters. This was like his tour, you know, with us as real little kids. And that was really exciting. You know, growing up in Detroit, it wasn't like, you know, we talked in Swahili at breakfast. It was just, it was more like that was the environment. I mean, all around you in any urban city in America, if you were black or white or whatever, that was the mood in the air, you know. It was really boring. I mean, I don't really consider myself a child of the 60s because I was so young I couldn't participate. I'm like a child of the 70s. So my thing is apathy. That's what I remember from high school. You know, just people sitting around going, wow, man, Hendrix is dead. You know, so.
You went to the Yale School of Drama.
Yeah.
And you got your start in theater and in films. And you were actually in a couple of musicals. You were in a musical based on the life of Jackie Robinson. You played Robinson.
Yes.
And I imagine had to do a lot of singing. Broadway
kind
of singing.
I can sing. I was in there, and that was my first job. It was my first job right out of school. As a matter of fact, they stopped me in the hallway, and they said, the casting director, they said, we're doing this musical on Jackie Robinson. Do you mind if we submit you? And I just burst out laughing. I thought it was pretty, you know, ludicrous. But I got the part, and it worked, and I was on Broadway, and it flopped. And it was an incredible experience. It was an incredible, I experienced everything, like 10 minutes of fame, half an hour of failure, a lot of money, no money, everything within a 6-month period, you know, it was all there. And it was great and scary and all that stuff. It was pretty emotional period.
Was it hard for you to get roles because of being black? Did you go through Hollywood shuffle kinds of stereotype auditions?
I think we all did because we all came out around the period when Eddie Murphy was really making it big. So we all went through the audition of they want an Eddie Murphy type, you know. And so in that sense, yeah. And I always played. For a while, I would get a lot of the, you know, sidekick roles, you know. And so until this show came along, I was kind of at a crossroads. I felt like my, you know, I always worked, but I didn't feel artistically or creatively challenged. And I remember driving home one day. I was making money and everything and living a good life. And I said, what am I? I mean, what do I do? Because when you do, like, guest episodes on sitcoms or soap opera or something that is just so inane, it just doesn't challenge you at all, then it's just a job, you know. And so it was pretty scary. I didn't know what I was, you know, and this show has changed all that.
So as someone who's played John's sidekick, what kind of sidekick roles did you get?
I was always like the partner. Like I was Gene Hackman's partner in Loose Cannons. I was the best friend when, you know, the couple's making love. I was a guy like peeking through the window going, come on, man, you're going to be late for work, you know, stuff like that. Countless movies, I was, you know, the best friend guy, you know, that kind of dude.
So what's a typical week like now on In Living Color when you know, when you're doing a new show?
Well, what we do is we come in on Monday or Tuesday. We have a read-through. We sit around the table, and we have a read-through. And we read through every sketch that is a possibility. We'll read through maybe 2 shows worth of material, usually 2.5 shows. And then we go away for lunch. And we come back, and already the editing has started. And from there is a lot of time where the actors begin forming and melding it. You know, this doesn't feel right. This doesn't sound right. Let me try this. I have an idea. And we play. You know, I'm in a cast with a group of people that are so great and so insane. Everyone's friends. We sit around all day, and we just act foolish and funny. And most of those characters come out of us waiting. When we're waiting around to rehearse or waiting for a rewrite, And we start egging each other on, because like other cast members would put us in situations and they make us do it. And a lot of that stuff is stuff that we find hilarious, you know, and we just do it all day, all night, and until finally someone says, we have to get that in a sketch.
What's it like being one of the actors who's not a weigh-ins on the show?
Man, it's hell. Brutal. I'm getting my name changed. You know what? In a way, it's great and it's fun. You know, Keenan, I have to say this, is he has created such a wonderful working environment. He inspires us, he cajoles us, he pushes us to create. This is a show that you can never sit back and just go for the ride, or else you just get swallowed up. I mean, you always have to be there pushing. And since he, in a way, is like the patriarch, because he's the oldest brother, you know, with Kim, sometimes they treat her like the little sister, you know what I mean? So she has to get past that whole thing. But I like not being a weigh-in, because I don't have to deal with that family dynamic, you know what I mean? I can just come in there and go, you know. But then again, like, you know, tickets to, like, the Grammys I don't get. I'm just kidding. Yeah.
Well, I love your work, and I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
You can see David Alan Greer Sunday nights on In Living Color on Fox Television. This is Fresh Air.
Hi, it's Noah Adams in Washington with a word about All Things Considered coming up. Concerning Ethiopia, a ceasefire has been announced in London by a United States mediator talking there with rebel groups and the interim government of Ethiopia. The U.S. has advised one of the rebel groups to move into the capital city, Addis Ababa, to prevent anarchy. President Bush says at a commencement address in Yale that China should retain its most favored nation trading status, but now he wants to limit the export of some high-tech items to China. We'll talk with a zoo director in Anchorage, Alaska, who's trying to find a new home for two baby grizzly bear cubs. And Bob Mondello has a rundown of this summer's hot movies. That's coming up later on NPR's All Things Considered.
Betty is an all-female singing trio which started out in Washington, D.C., but over the past few years, they've attracted something of a cult following through their concerts, club dates, and appearances on Scott Simon's NPR show on Saturday mornings. The group is comprised of Allison Palmer and sisters Bitsy and Amy Ziff. They've just released their first album. Critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
I used to think that actor and comedian Bill Murray had perfected the art of being simultaneously smug and goofy. Then last fall, I saw Betty in concert. Bill, I hate to break it to you, but you've been slimed. On stage, the three Bettys bounce from keyboard to cello to drum machine, dancing like drops of cooking oil hitting a hot skillet. They also mix and match stage roles, sometimes clowning around, sometimes coming on like vixens or tough rock and rollers, and undercutting every attitude with irony. Some of the people in the audience on the night I saw Betty looked confused, as though they came expecting a sexy group like Heart and instead got the Marx Brothers in drag. But if Betty's dance moves and affects are unpredictable, their vocal timing is split-second precise, and their lyrics as pointed as any of Dorothy Parker's aphorisms. Here's a characteristic Betty moment from the group's album.
You put my love, love no more, through the test. Love no more, tubes and all. Love no more, I won't be your experiment. Mr. Amoeba. Go ahead and split, Mr. Amoeba Man. I can't divide my love once again. Go ahead and split, Mr. Amoeba Man. Two, four, eight.
Betty's songs and monologues hit all the familiar girl group themes. Falling in love, unrequited love, and losing your lover to another woman. In their smart-alecky way, Betty also sings about the delicious power women feel when they mold themselves into sex objects. Of course, Madonna plays with this subject, too. Some Madonna theorists point out that she chooses to dress like a harem girl, so she isn't demeaning herself. Instead, Madonna is flaunting the power she has over the men who can't tear their eyes away from her. In songs like Ms. Snake, Betty confesses the even naughtier secret that women sometimes transform themselves into slithering temptresses, not only to ensnare men, but to make other women miserable. But Betty also demonstrates sisterly solidarity in songs like Wolf Woman, a sweet tribute to a woman with big teeth and excess facial hair who always spends her full moon evenings alone. Betty's sly silliness is ideal for those full moon evenings when you need a laugh and the I Love Lucy reruns are done for the day. You can't quite dance to Betty's music, which is why the Three Bettys look so clumsy on stage and why they'll probably never have a hit. But dancing interferes with listening, and you wouldn't want to miss the erotic subtext of Betty's version of Petticoat, excuse me, that's Betticoat Junction. Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Betty will perform at the Bottom Line in New York, June 7th and 8th, and at Club Cabaret in Boston, June 13th to the 23rd. Betty's new album is called Hello, Betty. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also directed today's show. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Joyce Lieberman, and Dan Lachlan. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Cicela Bach. Bach is a philosopher and the author of books on the ethics of lying and keeping secrets. Her new book is a memoir about her mother, who is called the most modern woman in the world, Alva Murdaugh. Both of Bach's parents were Nobel Prize winners. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.